Lincoln, Disc 33.
The larger part of his address reviewed his relationship to the reconstructed government of Louisiana and offered a defense of that regime. It wasn't in every way satisfactory, he admitted, and it would be more credible if it was supported by 20, 30, or 50,000 voters instead of the 12,000 who participated in its election. But he raised the same question that he'd asked Senator Trumbull during the recent session of Congress. Can Louisiana be brought into proper practical relation with the Union sooner by sustaining or by discarding her new state government? The answer, he thought, was obvious. Concede that the new government of Louisiana is only to what it should be as the egg is to the fowl. We shall sooner have the fowl by hatching the egg than by smashing it. And he reminded his listeners that if Louisiana wasn't readmitted, we also reject one vote in favor of the proposed amendment to the National Constitution. Lincoln never explained why he chose this forum and this occasion for a major statement on Reconstruction. But the final sentences of his talk gave a hint of his purpose. In the present situation, as the phrase goes, it may be my duty to make some new announcement to the people of the South, he said in conclusion, after many of his listeners had grown bored and drifted off elsewhere in search of more conventional oratory. I am considering, and shall not fail to act, when satisfied that action will be proper. The meaning of that cryptic message puzzled his hearers, who guessed that he intended anything from an announcement of amnesty for all rebels to a proclamation putting the entire South under military rule to a decree imposing universal suffrage on the rebellious states. None of these expectations was realistic. Certainly, Lincoln wasn't in favor of punishing the Confederates. As he said to the Marquis de Chambrun shortly after his talk, it was his firm resolution to stand for clemency against all opposition. He had no wish to capture and try even the leaders of the Confederacy. He hoped there would be no persecution, no bloody work after the war was over, he told the cabinet. None need expect he would take any part in hanging or killing those men, even the worst of them. Frighten them out of the country, open the gates, let down the bars, scare them off, he said, making a gesture as if herding sheep. But he wished to avoid making a public pronouncement on this point. At City Point, when Sherman asked what was to be done with Jefferson Davis and the other Confederate leaders, Lincoln intimated that they ought to escape the country, though he couldn't say so openly. To make his position clear, he told Sherman one of his favorite stories about the man who declined a drink because he'd taken a total abstinence pledge and asked for lemonade instead. When a friend suggested that it would taste better with a little brandy in it, the man said he wouldn't object if it could be added unbeknown to him. Nor was he about to issue a proclamation for the general reorganization of the southern states. The sole item on his agenda was peace, and Lincoln did not in this speech or elsewhere offer a broad vision of the future, outlining how the conquered South should be governed. He stipulated only that loyal men must rule. His wasn't the view of the conservatives, who simply wanted the rebellious states, without slavery, to return to their former position in the Union. Nor was it the view of the radicals who wanted to take advantage of this molten moment of history to recast the entire social structure of the South. He didn't share the conservatives' desire to put the section back into the hands of the planters and businessmen who'd dominated the South before the war, but he didn't adopt the radicals' belief that the only true unionists in the South were African Americans. Equally improbable was any announcement that African Americans must have full political and economic equality. Lincoln hadn't given much thought to the role that the freedmen would play in the reorganization of the South. The stalwart service rendered by nearly 200,000 African Americans in the military had eroded his earlier doubts about their courage and intelligence. Perhaps he still questioned whether blacks could ever achieve equality with whites in the same society. But the failure of his colonization schemes had taught him that African Americans were, and would remain, a permanent part of the American social fabric. He believed that the more intelligent blacks, especially those who served in the army, were entitled to the suffrage. Hence, he encouraged the education of the freedmen, and he supported the Freedmen's Bureau to protect them from exploitation by their former masters. But beyond this, he wasn't prepared to go. Unlike the radicals, he gave no thought to dividing up the estates of the defeated Southern planters and giving each black family 40 acres and a mule. He offered no opinions on school integration, interracial marriages, or social equality between blacks and whites. In April 1865, he thought these were all hypothetical questions, pernicious abstractions which could have no other effect than to divide the friends of the Union at a time when they ought to be united in a search for peace. The announcement he contemplated probably had to do with his plan to allow the members of the rebel legislature of Virginia to assemble in order to withdraw their state from the Confederacy. He was prepared to extend the same offer to other states. In his mind, this move didn't amount to recognition of the Confederate governments in these states, nor was he conceding that they'd ever seceded from the Union, a point central to his thinking throughout the war. But he contemplated giving a limited recognition to interim governments for the specific purpose of withdrawing troops from the Confederate armies. He'd returned from City Point with a new sense of urgency about Reconstruction. He now had first-hand knowledge of the devastation wrought by the war and a fuller understanding of the suffering it had caused soldiers and civilians in the South. More strongly than ever, he felt that immediate action must be taken to restore stability in the conquered region. Civil government must be reestablished as soon as possible, he told Welles. There must be courts and law and order, or society'd be broken up. The disbanded armies would turn into robber bands and guerrillas, which we must strive to prevent. Aware that his plan would arouse opposition, he intended his speech, as he told an old friend the next day, to blaze a way through the swamp of legal entanglements and political objections to his course. He had good reason to anticipate that radicals would oppose his efforts in Virginia. Many of them hadn't accepted their defeat in the recent session of Congress. Some, like Sumner, were now implacable in their hostility to Lincoln's plans. Aware that the president was likely to make some pronouncement on Reconstruction on April 11th, the senator had declined Mrs. Lincoln's invitation to view the victory celebration from the White House. He felt that his presence at the inaugural ball had been interpreted as giving symbolic approval of the Lincoln administration, and he wasn't going to allow himself to be so used again. Other radicals also continued to agitate for harsh terms toward the South. For instance, Benjamin F. Butler demanded that leaders of the rebellion should be disfranchised and disqualified from holding any public office, and that the masses, including the Negroes, should have the rights of citizenship. Chief Justice Chase, who didn't give up his political interests when he joined the court, enjoined the president to remember that the easiest and safest way to reorganize the southern states was through the enrollment of the loyal citizens without regard to complexion. Lincoln's April 11th speech was an attempt to defuse such criticisms by making significant concessions to his radical critics. Though he defended the Unionist government of Louisiana, he explicitly disavowed any claim that Reconstruction was exclusively a function of the executive branch. He reminded his audience that he had, from the outset, distinctly stated that this was not the only plan which might possibly be acceptable, and that the executive claimed no right to say when or whether members should be admitted to seats in Congress from such states. Admitting that he had promised General Banks to sustain the Louisiana regime, he was ready to retract it. "As bad promises are better broken than kept, I shall treat this as a bad promise and break it whenever I shall be convinced that keeping it is adverse to the public interest. But," he cautioned, "I've not yet been so convinced." Recognizing that radicals objected to the Louisiana Constitution because it didn't give African Americans the ballot, he declared that he shared their discontent. "I would myself prefer that it were now conferred on the very intelligent and on those who serve our cause as soldiers." This was an opinion Lincoln had previously expressed in private, but never before had any American president publicly announced that he was in favor of Negro suffrage. At least one member of the crowd outside the White House that night recognized how much Lincoln was conceding to the radicals. John Wilkes Booth fumed with hatred for the president. Born in Maryland, in a slaveholding community, the 26-year-old actor thought of himself as a northerner who understood the South. He was a handsome, vain young man, the next to the youngest son and his mother's darling in her brood of 10 children. He grew up on the family farm near Bel Air, Maryland, to which his alcoholic and mentally unstable father repaired between bouts of acting, and in Baltimore. Erratic attendance at several private schools in the vicinity supplied him with a smattering of learning, some elements of military drill, and a conviction that he belonged to the Southern gentry. He seemed destined for the theater. His father, Junius Brutus Booth, and his brother Edwin were great actors. His brother Junius Booth Jr. was a major producer, and his brother-in-law was a noted comedian. From his debut at the age of 17, Wilkes Booth was almost constantly on the stage. He had no training, and his early performances were crude and sometimes laughable. But he constantly improved as an actor, and he learned a formidable number of roles. He looked the part of the hero. Though he was only 5'8" tall, he held himself erect, and his broad chest contributed to the impression of greater height. Strikingly handsome, with curly black hair and a full mustache, He had a slightly exotic look, which women often found irresistible. He had an ivory pallor that contrasted with his raven hair, one of them remembered, and his eyes had heavy lids, which gave him an oriental touch of mystery. It was in southern theaters, notably in Richmond, that he first gained recognition. Southerners appreciated his flamboyant, athletic style of acting. The 12-foot leaps he sometimes used to make his first appearance on stage, the duels that were so realistic that blood was shed, the impassioned love scenes. When he began playing Shakespearean roles, considered the real test of an actor in the 1850s, he reminded audiences of his father, perhaps the greatest Shakespearean performer of his generation, and of Edwin Forrest. Southern audiences preferred Wilkes Booth's portrayal of Hamlet as an unmistakably mad prince, and of Richard III as a diabolical monster, to the coolly intellectual characterizations offered by his older brother Edwin. Offstage, Southerners found Wilkes Booth delightful, and they were charmed by his quick excitability, his love of fun, and his joyousness. "He was one of the best raconteurs to whom I ever listened," a fellow actor recalled. As he talked, he threw himself into his words, brilliant, ready, enthusiastic. Young Southern men were impressed by his ability to hold his liquor. His excellent manners won him access to social circles in the Deep South, from which he'd been excluded in Maryland, where people remembered that he was illegitimate. Deserting a first wife in England, his father had come to America with Marianne Holmes, who became the mother of John Wilkes Booth and his 9 siblings. Southerners also liked Wilkes Booth because he held conventional Southern views about slavery, which he considered one of the greatest blessings, both for themselves and us, that God ever bestowed upon a favored nation. He firmly believed the country was formed for the white, not for the black man. As sectional tensions mounted, he denounced what he called the treasonable activities of the abolitionist Republicans and called for retribution. "The South wants justice, has waited for it long, and she will wait no longer." Acting in a Richmond theater when he heard the news of John Brown's capture, he borrowed a uniform and went with the Richmond Grays to witness the execution of the old abolitionist. When the war broke out, Booth made no attempt to conceal his sympathies for the Confederacy. "So help me, holy God," he swore to his sister, "my soul, life, and possessions are for the South." But he didn't rush to enlist in the Confederate Army, explaining to his brother Edwin, a loyal supporter of the North, that he'd promised their mother to keep out of the quarrel. His contempt for President Lincoln was open. He was offended by this man's appearance, his pedigree, his coarse, low jokes and anecdotes, his vulgar similes, and his frivolity, as much as he was by Lincoln's effort to crush out slavery by robbery, rapine, slaughter, and bought armies. Booth did little more than grumble about Lincoln until August or September 1864, when the re-election of the president seemed increasingly probable. But he then decided that something must be done to rid the country of this false president, who clearly was yearning for kingly succession. No doubt the chronic hoarseness that was clouding his career as a theatrical star and the failure of his investments in Pennsylvania oil schemes to pay off contributed to his general unhappiness, which was now directed against the president. Exactly how Booth got in touch with the Confederate Secret Service isn't known. But he had many contacts in the South, and the private funds he'd used to buy quinine and other needed medicines to be smuggled into the Confederacy gave evidence of his good faith. Presently, after conferring with Southern agents in Maryland, in Boston, and in Canada, he came up with the scheme of kidnapping Lincoln, taking him behind the Confederate lines in Virginia, where he would be held hostage for the release of thousands of Southern soldiers languishing in Northern prisons. It can't be proved that any Confederate authority, much less the heads of the Confederate government, knew about, authorized, or even approved Booth's plan. Though it's clear that, at least at the lower levels of the Southern Secret Service, the abduction of the Union president was under consideration. Indeed, Booth's scheme was very much like the one that Confederate authorities permitted Thomas N. Conrad to attempt in the fall of 1864. Booth recruited for this plot two of his boyhood friends from Baltimore, Samuel B. Arnold and Michael O'Loughlin. Expecting to take the president across the Potomac below Washington, he added the Prussian-born George A. Astorat from Port Tobacco, Maryland, because he'd ferried Confederate spies across the river and knew all the creeks and inlets. John H. Surratt, who'd repeatedly served as a courier between secessionist sympathizers in Baltimore and Southern authorities in Richmond, added first-hand knowledge of the Confederate underground that was active in Southern Maryland. And his mother, Mary Surratt, who may or may not have known the plots that were being hatched, offered headquarters for the conspirators in the inn she owned at Surrattsville, Maryland, and in the boarding house she opened on H Street in Washington. For brute strength needed to overcome any resistance on the part of the president, Booth enrolled the burly, violent Lewis Payne, or Powell or Wood, as he variously called himself, who'd served in Mosby's Confederate Rangers before taking the oath of allegiance to the Union cause. And finally, he allowed the young druggist's clerk, David E. Harold, to join the group. Harold was a trifler who gave the appearance of being not very bright, but as an avid bird hunter, he was supposed to know the poorly mapped roads below Washington. It was a loose, informally organized group, tied together only by devotion to the Confederate cause, personal attachment to Booth, and the considerable amounts of money that the actor paid to house and feed his team in Washington. During the fall and winter of 1864, while Booth was recruiting his band of conspirators, he spent much time studying the maps and exploring the roads in Charles County, Maryland, in order to plan for carrying the kidnapped president across the Potomac. The whole venture, despite its deadly seriousness, had a theatrical quality about it. And at times, Booth, who had trouble separating fantasy from reality, seemed to be playing one of his more melodramatic theatrical roles. To make sure that nobody misunderstood the script that he was following, he took time to write an impassioned letter explaining his actions in advance, which he sealed and entrusted to his brother-in-law. "There's no time for words," he asserted, only to run on for some 1,300 words, attacking Lincoln, defending the South, and announcing that he intended to make for her a prisoner of this man to whom she owes so much misery. He signed the document, "A Confederate at present doing duty on his own responsibility." Then he paused and struck through at present. How much of this was play-acting is hard to determine. Certainly Booth's first plan, to capture Lincoln while he was attending Ford's Theater on January 18th, bind him and lower him from the box to the stage, and then carry him off to the Confederacy, was pure theater, more akin to farce than to tragedy. Only an inferior playwright could conceive a scenario in which the powerful 6-foot-4-inch Lincoln could be bound and gagged while 1,000 spectators quietly watched the abduction. The plan was never tried, because the president stayed at home on this stormy night. A more practicable plan for abducting the president, similar to that of Conrad, the Confederate agent, was to capture him while he was riding in his carriage on the outskirts of the city. Learning that Lincoln planned to attend a performance of Still Waters Run Deep at the Campbell Hospital near the Soldiers' Home on March 17th, the conspirators decided to intercept the president, overpower him and his coachman, and rush him through southeastern Maryland and across the Potomac. At the last minute, the attempt had to be aborted when Booth learned that Lincoln had remained in the city to review a returning regiment of Indiana volunteers rather than attend the play. Instead of discouraging Booth, these failures led him to contemplate a new course of action. As early as March 4th, even before the failure of the kidnapping scheme, he'd begun to think of assassination rather than abduction. Standing in the rotunda of the Capitol as Lincoln passed through to the portico, where he gave his second inaugural address, Booth reflected on the excellent chance he had to kill the president if he wished. The failure of the abduction scheme made that wish an obsession. Because the collapse of the Confederacy removed the source of any orders or suggestions for his conspiracy, Booth was now acting entirely on his own, and there was nothing to curb his fervid imagination. Drinking very heavily at this time, he increasingly came to think of himself as not just a self-appointed Confederate secret agent, but as the reincarnation of one of the tragic theatrical heroes whose lines he mouthed so eloquently. Sometimes he fancied himself a present-day William Tell. More often, he saw himself as Brutus, striking down the despotic Caesar. Always he brought death to the tyrant. Lincoln's address on April 11th triggered Booth's shift from thought to action. In the crowd outside the White House that evening, he heard the president recommend suffrage for blacks who were educated or had served in the Union armies. "That means nigger citizenship," the actor muttered and vowed. "That's the last speech he'll ever make." He urged Lewis Payne to shoot the president on the spot. When Payne refused, Booth turned in disgust to his other companion, David Harold, and exclaimed, "By God, I'll put him through." Lincoln, of course, knew nothing of these plots as he continued to plan for a speedy restoration of the Union under lenient terms of Reconstruction. But he found few were ready to follow his lead. In Virginia, Campbell and his associates in the Virginia legislature seemed to be dragging their feet. On April 6th, the president had authorized them to meet, but nothing much happened. During the next 3 days, while fighting continued, Campbell took time to constitute a committee of the legislators. The committee took time to compose an address. The military took time to approve the address, and then it had to be published in the newspapers. It took more time to assure the members of the legislature that they would be given safe conduct and provided with transportation to Richmond. Lacking any sense of urgency, Campbell took an increasingly enlarged view of his role in the negotiations, calling for an armistice, something that Lincoln had explicitly refused, and suggesting peace negotiations with the Confederate legislature of South Carolina as well as that of Virginia. It seems not to have occurred to him that Lee's surrender on April 9th made his activities largely irrelevant. Along with foot-dragging from the Confederates, Lincoln had to deal with opposition in the North. Radicals overwhelmingly rejected the compromises he'd offered in his April 11th speech. One of Sumner's abolitionist correspondents in Boston thought that it again demonstrated Lincoln's backwardness and argued that it will be wicked and blasphemous for us as a nation to allow any distinction of color whatever in the reconstructed states. Sumner agreed. He rejected Lincoln's egg and fowl metaphor for the Louisiana government, an image the president was particularly pleased with, noting grimly that only crocodiles emerge from crocodile eggs. By failing to adopt a just and safe system of reconstruction, meaning one that enfranchised all the freedmen, the president was going to promote confusion and uncertainty in the future with hot controversy. Alas, alas, he grieved. The president's immediate advisers also objected to the proposed meeting of the Virginia legislators, which seemed much less urgent after Lee surrendered at Appomattox. He had deliberately not broached the subject in the cabinet meeting before he gave his speech, but some of the members knew about the plan because Charles A. Dana, who was with the president at City Point, sent Stanton detailed reports on Lincoln's meetings with Campbell. Stanton apparently leaked news of the Virginia peace negotiations to Speed and Dennison, and he possibly also informed Chief Justice Chase. On April 12th, when Lincoln brought the question of Virginia Reconstruction before the cabinet, nobody favored his plan. Afterward, both Stanton and Speed had private interviews with the president in order to express their marked dissatisfaction and irritation with the proposal. In a second conversation that afternoon at the War Department, Stanton vehemently argued against allowing the rebel legislature to assemble or the rebel organizations to have any participation whatever in the business of reorganization. And he warned that Lincoln's action would put the government in the hands of its enemies, that it would surely bring trouble with Congress, and that the people wouldn't sustain him. With Seward bedridden, Lincoln thought his strongest supporter would be Gideon Welles. But the Secretary of the Navy, to his surprise, also objected to the policy of convening a rebel legislature. The president explained that all he was trying to do was to effect a reconciliation as soon as possible, and he shouldn't stickle about forms provided he could attain the desired result. But Welles wasn't convinced. As we'd never recognized any of the Confederate organizations as possessing validity during the war, he argued, it would be impolitic, to say the least, to now recognize them and their governments as legal. Besides, he pointed out, there already was a Unionist government of Virginia, headed by Francis Pierpont. Rather feebly, the president countered that the Pierpont government could be considered legal, but public sentiment or public prejudice mustn't be overlooked. But Wells's argument registered, and shortly afterward, when Pierpont came to the White House for a conference, Lincoln assured him, "I intended to recognize the restored government, of which you were head, as the rightful government of Virginia." With all his advisers opposed to the reassembling of the Virginia legislature, the president concluded, as he told Wells, that he had perhaps made a mistake and was ready to correct it if he had. He decided to get out of the Virginia scheme with the best grace he could. If he'd blundered because of insufficient preparation and imprecise directives, he could blame the Southerners for dilatoriness and misinterpretation of his orders. On April 12th, he wired General Weitzel that Campbell had exceeded his authority, reminding the general that he'd permitted the calling not of the legislature, but of the gentlemen who have acted as the legislature of Virginia in support of the rebellion. Lincoln denied that he'd ever intended to recognize them as a rightful body. They were only a group of influential individuals who had the power to withdraw Virginia support from resistance to the United States. Their action wasn't needed now, particularly as General Grant has since captured the Virginia troops, so that giving a consideration for their withdrawal is no longer applicable. "Do not now allow them to assemble," he directed Weitzel. "But if any have come, allow them safe return to their homes." Consequently, Lincoln never made the announcement to the people of the South promised in his speech of April 11th. What he considered a temporary setback didn't dishearten him, and he continued to plan a speedy restoration of the Confederate States to the Union on the most generous terms. This was the principal subject of discussion in the cabinet meeting on Friday, April 14th, which General Grant attended. The president was in great form. Speed thought he'd never seen him in better spirits, and Stanton remarked that he was grander, graver, more thoroughly up to the occasion than he'd ever seen him. According to Frederick W. Seward, who attended in place of his injured father, all members expressed kindly feeling toward the vanquished and a hearty desire to restore peace and safety at the South with as little harm as possible to the feelings or the property of the inhabitants. The cabinet quickly agreed on the importance of promptly restoring normal commercial relations with the former Confederate States, and of abolishing, as soon as possible, all the military and treasury regulations that had been necessary during the war to govern trade with the South. With obvious pleasure, the president responded to a petitioner who asked for a pass to permit him to travel to Virginia. "No pass is necessary now to authorize anyone to go to and return from Petersburg and Richmond. People go and return just as they did before the war." How the Southern states were to be governed during the transition from disunion to loyalty remained to be settled. Lincoln had now given up the idea of temporarily working with the rebel legislatures, admitting to the cabinet that he had perhaps been too fast in his desires for early Reconstruction. But he felt strongly that the reorganization of these states couldn't be directed from Washington. "We can't undertake to run state governments in all these Southern states," he told the cabinet. "Their people must do that. Though I reckon that at first some of them may do it badly." Stanton brought up a plan for the appointment of military governors who would rule under martial law in the South until civilian rule could be reestablished. Under his proposal, which he'd submitted to the president the previous day, and had also discussed with Grant, the military authorities would preserve order and enforce the laws while the several executive departments resumed their normal functions in the South. The Treasury Department would proceed to collect the revenues. The Interior Department would set its Indian agents, surveyors, and land and pension agents to work. The Postmaster General would establish post offices and mail routes, and so on. This was, Lincoln noted approvingly, substantially, in its general scope, the plan which we had sometimes talked over in cabinet meetings, and it would bear further study. But Stanton also called for a single military governor for Virginia and North Carolina, and Welles strongly objected to the eradication of state boundaries and stressed the commitment that the administration had made to the Pierpont regime in Virginia. Tactfully, Lincoln handled the disagreement among his advisers by asking Stanton to revise his proposal, making separate plans for Virginia and North Carolina, which required different treatment. As to the former, the president said, "We mustn't stultify ourselves as regards Virginia, but we must help her," declaring that he'd not yet had a chance to study the details of Stanton's proposal. He urged all the members to think carefully about the subject of Reconstruction, because no greater or more important one could come before us or any future cabinet. It was providential, he observed, that the administration could settle on a plan for Reconstruction without interference from the disturbing elements of Congress, which was in recess. "If we were wise and discreet," the president told his cabinet, "we should reanimate the states and get their governments in successful operation, with order prevailing and the Union reestablished before Congress came together in December. We could do better," he assured his advisers, "accomplish more without than with them." There were men in Congress, he observed, who, if their motives were good, were nevertheless impracticable, and who possessed feelings of hate and vindictiveness in which he didn't sympathize and couldn't participate. The discussion then drifted to the military situation, and everybody wanted to hear Grant's account of the surrender at Appomattox. Asking what terms had been extended to the common soldiers in the rebel army, Lincoln beamed when Grant said, "I told them to go back to their homes and families, and they wouldn't be molested if they did nothing more." Cabinet members wanted to know whether there was any news from Sherman in North Carolina. Grant replied that he was expecting word momentarily. Lincoln remarked that he was confident that there soon would be good news, since the previous night he'd had the recurrence of a dream. He was on the water, and he seemed to be in some singular, indescribable vessel, and he was moving with great rapidity towards an indefinite shore. This dream, he said, had come to him before nearly every important Union victory. Antietam, Gettysburg, Stones River, Vicksburg, Fort Fisher, and so on. Grant, who had no faith in superstitions and dreams, interjected that Stones River was certainly no northern victory. Looking at the general curiously, Lincoln continued that, judging from the past, the dream meant that there'd be good news soon. "I think it must be from Sherman," he said. "My thoughts are in that direction, as are most of yours." Absorbing as were the prospects for victory and peace, they didn't occupy all the president's time, even on so eventful a day. He'd been up since 7 o'clock dealing with routine business, such as the appointment of one William T. Howell as Indian agent in Michigan. After breakfast, where he heard details of Lee's surrender at Appomattox from Robert, who was just back from Grant's army, the president went back to his office to face the endless line of visitors and petitioners who were waiting for him. In the next 2 hours, he had a conversation with Speaker of the House Schuyler Colfax and Representative Cornelius Cole about California and the Western Territories, a brief talk with William A. Howard, the postmaster of Detroit, a conference with Senator J. A.J. Creswell of Maryland about patronage, an audience with John P. Hale, whom he'd recently appointed minister to Spain, and an interview with Charles M. Scott, a Mississippi riverboat pilot whose cotton had been confiscated by the Confederates. After slipping away for a brief visit to the War Department in the hope of receiving more news from the armies, Lincoln returned to the White House in time for the cabinet meeting at 11. After the cabinet meeting, too busy to have lunch, the president ate an apple as he went back to his office. There he held more interviews, read more petitions, signed more papers. This was proving to be the usual exhausting day of a busy chief executive, but Lincoln, now that the long ordeal of war was over, handled his duties expeditiously and efficiently. Indeed, since the news of Lee's surrender, his associates found he acted like a different man. His whole appearance, poise, and bearing had marvelously changed, Senator Harlan recalled. He seemed the very personification of supreme satisfaction. His conversation was, of course, correspondingly exhilarating. At 3 o'clock, he broke away from his desk to take a ride with Mary in an open carriage. As they started out, she asked whether he wanted any guests to accompany them, but he said, "No, I prefer to ride by ourselves today." They drove about the city and went out to the Navy Yard in southeastern Washington, where the president chatted with several of the sailors and went aboard the Montauk, a monitor that had been hit 47 times during the assault on Charleston Harbor. Throughout the afternoon, he was cheerful, almost joyous, his wife recalled, and his spirits were so high that she said to him, laughing, "Dear husband, you almost startled me by your great cheerfulness." "And well, I may feel so, Mary," he responded. "I consider this day, the war has come to a close." He then added, in what was as close to a reprimand as he ever offered to his wife, "We must both be more cheerful in the future. Between the war and the loss of our darling Willie, we've both been very miserable." Back at the White House, Lincoln found still more visitors, and he had a long chat with Governor Richard J. Oglesby and General Isham Haney, both of Illinois, to whom he read so many chapters of the Nasby letters that he had to be summoned several times to dinner. The meal was served early because the Lincolns had promised to attend a performance of the comedy Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater. By this time, Mary had developed a headache and was inclined to stay home, but her husband said that he must attend. The evening newspapers had carried an announcement that he'd be present, and tickets had been sold on the basis of that expectation. Anyway, he added, if he remained at the White House, he'd have to receive company all evening and would get no rest. Even as the Lincolns prepared to get in their carriage, he had to deal with yet more callers. Just as they were leaving, Congressman Isaac N. Arnold walked up. "Excuse me now," Lincoln said. "I'm going to the theater. Come and see me in the morning." Lincoln's advisers urged him not to go to the theater. Before leaving on a mission to Richmond, Lehman, who often served as a presidential bodyguard, begged him, "Promise me you won't go out at night while I'm gone, particularly to the theater." But the president had so often heard the marshal on this subject that, as Lehman said later, he thought me insane upon the subject of his safety. And he'd only pledge, "Well, I promise to do the best I can toward it." Stanton, too, repeatedly warned Lincoln against mingling with promiscuous crowds at the theater. The occasion this evening was more dangerous than most, because it had been widely advertised that General Grant, fresh from his victories in Virginia, would join the president in the state box at Ford's Theater. The Lincolns had trouble making up a theater party on April 14th, perhaps because it was Good Friday. They invited the Stantons, but the Secretary of War refused because he said, "Mr. Lincoln ought not to go. It was too great an exposure." Anyway, Mrs. Stanton disliked Mrs. Lincoln. After initially accepting a verbal invitation, Grant also declined. Julia Grant, who remembered all too well Mary Lincoln's behavior during her visit to City Point, was unwilling to be confined for hours in a box at the theater with a woman of such uncertain temper. She decided to visit her children in Burlington, New Jersey. And the general, always glad of an excuse to escape the limelight, asked to be excused so he could join her. Governor Oglesby and General Haney were asked, but they had a meeting to attend. Lincoln invited Howard, the Detroit postmaster, but he was leaving Washington that evening. William H. Wallace, governor of Idaho Territory, and his wife also declined. On one of his visits to the War Department, Lincoln asked Stanton if Major Thomas T. Eckert, chief of the Telegraph Bureau, could accompany him to the theater. Eckert was a man of exceptional strength, who once, in order to demonstrate the poor quality of the cast-iron pokers that were supplied for use at the War Department grates, broke five of them by striking them across his left arm. Here, surely, was a man who could defend the president against whatever danger Stanton feared. But the secretary said that Eckert was needed for important work. Going over Stanton's head, the president approached Eckert directly. "Now, Major," he cajoled, "come along. You can do Stanton's work tomorrow, and Mrs. Lincoln and I want you with us." But Eckert, in deference to the secretary's wishes, declined. The Lincolns next turned to a young couple of whom they were fond, Clara Harris, the daughter of the senator from New York, and her stepbrother, who was also her fiancé, Major Henry R. Rathbone, who'd served with distinction in the war and could presumably offer the president protection. After picking up their guests, the Lincolns drove to Ford's Theater on 10th Street through streets still illuminated in celebration of the recent victory. By the time they arrived, at about 8:30, the performance had already begun, though the spectators kept glancing at the empty presidential box. There had been some grumbling because, in anticipation that both Lincoln and Grant would attend, scalpers bought up most of the tickets, which regularly cost 75 cents or a dollar, and resold them for $2.50 each. But when the president and his party entered, the orchestra, led by William Withers, interrupted the actors and played "Hail to the Chief," and the audience rose and cheered. As he climbed the stairs to the dress circle, the president walked slowly, and his shoulders seemed noticeably stooped. Carrying his high silk hat in his left hand, he led the way along a narrow corridor to the presidential box. Actually, it was two boxes, but the management had removed the partition between them to give more room for the presidential party. The audience continued wildly cheering, and one witness remembered, the president stepped to the box rail and acknowledged the applause with dignified bows and never-to-be-forgotten smiles. Knowing that the president preferred a rocking chair, Harry C. Ford, brother of the owner of the theater, had thoughtfully provided one from his private quarters. And there were also comfortable chairs and a small sofa for the other guests. The velvet balustrade in front of the box, 11 feet and 6 inches above the stage, had been decorated with patriotic colors, and the blue regimental flag of the Treasury Guard flew above a gilt-framed portrait of George Washington on the center pillar. The occupants of the box could not be seen by most of the audience. The play, which starred Laura Keene, was a creaky farce about an American bumpkin, Asa Trenchard, who goes to England to claim a fortune he's inherited from a noble relative. He's pursued by a fortune-hunting Englishwoman, Mrs. Mountchessington, who wants to marry him to her daughter Augusta. The play'd been a hit for 5 years, and the lines were familiar enough to allow the actors a little improvisation for special occasions like this one. So when the frail heroine asked for a seat protected from the draft, Lord Dundreary, instead of saying, "Well, you're not the only one that wants to escape the draft," replied, "You're mistaken. The draft has already been stopped by order of the president." Though the draperies concealed the president so that he could only be seen when he leaned forward, the Lincolns appeared to enjoy the play. When the actors scored hits, Mary applauded, but her husband simply laughed heartily. A man seated in the orchestra observed that Mrs. Lincoln often called the president's attention to actions on the stage and seemed to take great pleasure in witnessing his enjoyment. Seated so close to her husband that she was nestled against him, she whispered, "What will Miss Harris think of my hanging on to you so?" With a smile, he replied, "She won't think anything about it." One of the most predictable crowd pleasers in the play came during the second scene of the third act, when Mrs. Mountchessington, learning that Asa Trenchard has given away his inheritance, denounces him for not knowing how to behave and makes a haughty exit. Asa's lines read, "Don't know the manners of good society, eh? Well, I guess I know enough to turn you inside out, old gal. You sockdologizing old man-trap." The laughter and burst of applause almost covered the sound of a shot in the presidential box. John Wilkes Booth had been busy since the night of April 11th. "Our cause being almost lost," he concluded, "something decisive and great must be done." Remembering that Jefferson Davis was still at large and that Johnston's army in North Carolina was still under arms, he devised a plan to give the Confederacy one last chance by decapitating the Union government at Washington. Both Lincoln and Andrew Johnson would be killed. Seward would also be murdered, since, as Secretary of State, he would have the responsibility for holding new elections in the North. In the demoralization and disorder that would surely follow, the South might still gain its independence. Booth had trouble getting his fellow conspirators to go along with his plan. John Surratt, the ablest of his associates, went off on a trip to Canada for his Confederate employers. Accusing Booth of mismanagement and fearing that the government suspicions something is going on, Arnold favored postponing action until someone could go and see how it'll be taken at Richmond. Later, he decided to cut loose from Booth's scheme and took a job as a clerk at Old Point. O'Loughlin, too, was disillusioned. Willing enough to take part in a kidnapping, he wanted no part of a murder. But Booth still had three devoted followers, Atzerodt, Harold, and Payne. It was not until midday on April 14th, when he learned that Lincoln would be attending Ford's Theater, that Booth decided to implement his plan. At about 8 o'clock, he summoned Atzerodt to meet him and Payne at the Herndon House, where he gave them their marching orders. Atzerodt was told to murder Andrew Johnson, who was staying at the Kirkland House. "I won't do it," the German said in terror. "I enlisted to abduct the President of the United States, not to kill." But under Booth's threats and curses, he agreed to consider the assignment. Payne willingly accepted the order to kill Seward. Calling Booth captain, he thought of himself as a soldier obeying the commands of a superior officer. Because Payne wasn't familiar with the streets of Washington, Booth directed Harold to show him the way to the house of the Secretary of State. The assassination of the president was left for Booth himself, who expected to have some assistance in making his getaway from Edmund Spangler and other stagehands at Ford's Theater. All three assaults were to take place simultaneously at 10:15 p.m. In anticipation of the slaughter, Booth prepared a letter for publication in the National Intelligencer, explaining and defending his motives. The friend to whom he entrusted the letter destroyed it and remembered only its closing words. "The world may censure me for what I am about to do, but I am sure that posterity will justify me." The communication probably contained the same ideas that Booth later jotted down in his diary, where he recorded that the country owed all its troubles to Lincoln, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment. He was a modern Brutus or William Tell, though his action would be seen as purer than that of either. They had private motives, but I struck for my country, and that alone. A country groaned beneath this tyranny and prayed for this end. As Atzerodt and Payne fanned out to seek their targets, Booth, a celebrated actor, familiar to everybody who worked at Ford's Theater, had no trouble in slipping upstairs during the performance of Our American Cousin. Moving quietly down the aisle behind the dress circle, he stood for a few moments near the president's box. A member of the audience, seeing him there, thought him the handsomest man I had ever seen. John Parker, the metropolitan policeman assigned to protect the president, had left his post in the passageway, and the box was guarded only by Charles Forbes, a White House footman. When Booth showed Forbes his calling card, he was admitted to the presidential box. Barring the door behind him, so as not to be disturbed, he noiselessly moved behind Lincoln, who was leaning forward with his chin in his right hand and his arm on the balustrade. At a distance of about 2 feet, the actor pointed his derringer at the back of the president's head on the left side and pulled the trigger. It was about 10:13 p.m. When Major Rathbone tried to seize the intruder, Booth lunged at him with his razor-sharp hunting knife, which had a 7 1/4-inch blade. The knife, Clara Harris reported, went from the elbow nearly to the shoulder, inside, cutting an artery, nerves, and veins. He bled so profusely as to make him very weak. Shoving his victim aside, Booth placed his hands on the balustrade and vaulted toward the stage. It was an easy leap for the gymnastic actor, but the spur on his heel caught in the flags decorating the box, and he fell heavily on one foot, breaking the bone just above the ankle. Waving his dagger, he shouted in a loud, melodramatic voice, "Sic semper tyrannis," thus always to tyrants, the motto of the state of Virginia. Some in the audience thought he added, "The South is avenged." Quickly, he limped across the stage with what one witness called a motion like the hopping of a bullfrog, and made his escape through the rear of the theater. Up to this point, the audience wasn't sure what had happened. Perhaps most thought the whole disturbance was part of the play. But as the blue-white smoke from the pistol drifted out of the presidential box, Mary Lincoln gave a heart-rending shriek and screamed, "They've shot the president! They've shot the president!" The first doctor to reach the box, Army Surgeon Charles A. Leal, initially thought the president was dead. With his eyes closed and his head fallen forward on his breast, he was being held upright in his chair by Mrs. Lincoln, who was weeping bitterly. Detecting a slight pulse, the physician ordered the president to be stretched on the floor so that he could determine the extent of his injuries. Finding his major wound was at the back of his head, he removed the clot of blood that had accumulated there and relieved the pressure on his brain. Then, by giving artificial respiration, he was able to induce a feeble action of the heart, and irregular breathing followed. As soon as it was clear that instant death would not occur, the president was moved from the crowded theater. Some wanted to take him to the White House, but Dr. Leal warned that he would die if jostled on the rough streets of Washington. They decided to carry him across 10th Street to a house owned by William Peterson, a merchant tailor. There he was taken to a small, narrow room at the rear of the first floor. Because Lincoln was so tall, his body couldn't fit on the bed unless his knees were elevated. Finding that the foot of the bedstead could not be removed or broken off, the doctors placed him diagonally across the mattress, resting his head and shoulders on extra pillows. Though he was covered by an army blanket and a colored wool coverlet, his extremities grew very cold, and the physicians ordered hot water bottles. Here Lincoln lay for the next 9 hours. Dr. Leal and Dr. Charles S. Taft, who'd also been in the audience for Our American Cousin, were constantly in attendance. And during the night, as Taft noted, nearly all the leading men of the profession in the city tendered their services. When Dr. Robert King Stone, the Lincoln's family doctor, arrived at about 11 o'clock, he became the physician in charge, and he consulted with Dr. Joseph K. Barnes, the Surgeon General of the United States. From the first, all of them agreed that there was no chance of recovery. The doctors agreed that the average man couldn't survive the injury Lincoln had received for more than 2 hours. But Dr. Stone noted that the president's vital tenacity was very strong, and he would resist as long as any man could. He never regained consciousness. Mary was with her husband through the long night. Frantic with grief, she sat at his bedside, calling on him to say one word to her, to take her with him. When Robert came in with Senator Sumner, he saw what desperate shape his mother was in and sent for Elizabeth Dixon, wife of Connecticut Senator James Dixon, who was perhaps Mary's closest friend in the Capitol. Mrs. Dixon persuaded her to retire to the front room of the Peterson house, where she rested as well as she could, returning every hour to her husband's side. On one of these visits she sobbed bitterly, "Oh, that my little Taddy might see his father before he died!" But the physicians wisely decided that this wasn't advisable. Once, when Lincoln's breathing became very stertorous, Mary, who was approaching exhaustion, became frightened, leapt up with a piercing cry, and fell fainting on the floor. Coming in from the adjoining room, Stanton called out loudly, "Take that woman out, and do not let her in again." During the night, as crowds gathered in the street in front of the Peterson house, all the members of the cabinet except Seward came to see their fallen chief. Much of the night, Secretary Welles sat by the head of the president's bed, listening to the slow, full respiration of the dying man. Vice President Johnson was summoned, but Sumner urged him not to stay long, knowing that Mary Lincoln detested him and might cause a scene. The Reverend Phineas D. Gurley, pastor of the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, which the Lincolns frequently attended, came to give spiritual comfort. Stanton promptly took charge. Making an adjacent room in the Peterson house his headquarters, he summoned Assistant Secretary of War Dana to help him and began rapidly dictating one order after another designed to keep the government functioning during the crisis. Stanton immediately started an investigation of the assassination, taking testimony from witnesses, ordering all bridges and roads out of the Capitol closed, and directing the military to search for the murderers. By dawn, he had a massive manhunt underway. He soon learned that there had not been one but two assaults. Though Atzerodt decided not to attack Andrew Johnson and spent the night wandering aimlessly about the city, Payne, following Booth's directions, had burst into Seward's house. He fiercely attacked the Secretary of State, who was still bedridden after his carriage accident, and left him bleeding copiously and barely alive. By morning, Payne and Atzerodt were under arrest, and the other conspirators, including those who'd only been involved in the kidnapping plot, were promptly seized. But Booth, who was accompanied by Harold, escaped. Not until April 26th did Stanton's men trace him to a farm in northern Virginia, where he was shot. Long before that, Lincoln was dead. As the night of April 14th to 15th wore on, his pulse became irregular and feeble, and his respiration was accompanied by a guttural sound. Several times it seemed that he'd ceased breathing. Mary was allowed to return to her husband's side, and, as Mrs. Dixon reported, she again seated herself by the president, kissing him and calling him every endearing name. As his breath grew fainter and fainter, she was led back into the front room. At 7:22, on the morning of April 15th, the struggle ended, and the physicians came in to inform her, "It is all over. The president is no more." In the small, crowded back room, there was silence until Stanton asked Dr. Gurley to offer a prayer. Robert gave way to overpowering grief and sobbed aloud, leaning on Sumner for comfort. Standing at the foot of the bed, his face covered with tears, Stanton paid tribute to his fallen chief. With a slow and measured movement, his right arm fully extended as if in a salute, he raised his hat and placed it for an instant on his head, and then in the same deliberate manner removed it. "Now," he said, "he belongs to the ages."
The End. You've been listening to Lincoln by David Herbert Donald, narrated by Norman Dietz. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Angels and Ages, a short book about Darwin, Lincoln, and modern life by Adam Gopnik, narrated by the author. On a memorable day in human history, February 12, 1809, two babies were born an ocean apart. Abraham Lincoln in a one-room Kentucky log cabin, Charles Darwin on an English country estate. Searching for the men behind the icons of emancipation and evolution, Adam Gopnik shows us in this captivating double life Lincoln and Darwin as they really were, family men and social climbers, ambitious manipulators and courageous adventurers, the living husband, father, son, and student behind every myth. How do we reconcile Lincoln, the supremely good man we know, with the hardened commander who wittingly sent tens of thousands of young soldiers to certain death? Why did the relentlessly rational Darwin delay publishing his great idea for almost 20 years? How did inconsolable grief at the loss of a beloved child change each man? And what comfort could either find, for himself or for a society now possessed of a sadder, if wiser, understanding of our existence? Such human questions and their answers are the stuff of this book. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.